Hey everybody, today's guest is bass guitarist Carl Alvarez from the Fort Collins, Colorado punk rock band, Descendants. Together, we tackle the writing, recording, and inspiration behind the fan favorite hit, I'm the One, taken from their 1996 album, Everything Sucks. Now, we've heard this a lot here on Krista Makes a Podcast, but one of the very first things that Carl said about this track is that it was written in about 20 minutes. Descendants' well-known roadie and stage manager, Daniel Bug Snow, had complained to Carl about his ongoing relationship struggles, and it wasn't long after that the idea for the song came. And who can't relate to the lyrics? Seeing someone you care about dearly continue to put vested interest in the wrong people. This song is a mere 2 minutes and 15 seconds. But there's not a speck of fat on the bone here. Every note, word, and feeling has its own spot and purpose. Drummer Bill Stevenson and guitarist Stephen Egerton produced and engineered this masterpiece, and Andy Wallace absolutely slayed the mix. 27 years later and the track doesn't sound dated at all. So for all this and a whole lot more, stick around.
Hey, hey, have you heard? Krista Makes a Podcast. Hey, hey, have you heard? Krista Makes a Podcast. Hey, hey, have you heard?
Carl, how's it going?
Pretty good, Chris. How you doing?
I'm doing great. I just saw you a couple weeks ago.
Yeah, it was only 2 weeks ago.
2 weeks ago. Yeah, we played Fest down in Gainesville together. It's always amazing to see you guys. You're ageless, just like Less Than Jake. cough, cough. but man, you know, you're the last one in Descendants to be on the show. I've had every one of you guys, and I'm just so stoked to dive into I'm the One, because my top 10 rotates, but I'm the One is probably always in there. It's one of my favorite Descendants songs. Just everything about it. And I want you to take us back now. You know, the record Everything Sucks was recorded in June and July of 96. But do you remember writing the song? And was it something you had written for all, or was it specifically written in mind for Descendants?
I don't know. I don't think we really think about which song's gonna go where. But I can tell you where that song kind of came from, which is there were a bunch of younger people that had a loft in downtown Fort Collins, and they'd throw shows there. And I went there, and on the bill that night was Daniel Snow, Bug, our roadies band, Bill the Welder.
Mm-hmm.
And it was kind of, I came back and I had listened to Bug talk about his lack of good luck with women that he is obsessed with. And I sat on the couch, and then there was a few other friends who had given me similar laments over the past while there. And so I sat on the couch, and I think that song wrote itself in like seriously like 20 minutes. Weird as that sounds.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
And I just kind of sat down and wrote it, and you know, there it is.
Would this have been between the Interscope All record and Everything Sucks somewhere in between there? Like, had that tour finished up, the All tour?
I think we were already committed to the Descendants record.
You were, okay.
To the Everything Sucks record.
Okay, because this is well known, and I went back and listened to it. There's a demo with Chad singing on I'm the One. You can find it on YouTube.
It's a fight. After all he said and all he's done, I'm the one. I've been here for you all along. I'm the one. The shoulder you can cry on.
And it's amazing, save for the beginning of the track. The intro is a little bit shorter. The rest of the song's identical. It's a little bit faster. It doesn't have as much groove. I think it's maybe a click or two slower on the actual recording. So I thought maybe this was something that all was working up for the next record.
You know what? If things had gone differently, it probably would have been. Like I said, I don't really think about it that much about who's going to sing it, you know. But I mean, once you get in the studio, almost anything can happen. And with that song, one of the things I remember happening is we changed the key of it to accommodate an easier singing of it, which was fine, except for from the bass end of it, it created a situation which was pretty easy and made it very difficult, where in that song I will hit the lowest fretted note on the bass
yeah.
and the highest one in like this really limited amount of time. And that's purely a byproduct of changing the key of the song. I think it was a half step lower before, and I was able to get away with an open note or something. But, you know, I'm up for the challenge. It was like, okay, this is going to be really pointlessly difficult, but I'll do it.
You know what? I've never thought about that, Carl. Have you ever, you know, dialed up a bass tone and you're like, you're playing this really low part. It sounds great. And you want to go up to an octave way higher. And it's like, it sounds terrible up there. And you have to accommodate the sound from that.
Yeah, of course. You got to pay attention to where you are relative to the guitar, too. You know,
sure, sure.
The Ramones were artists with that. They were, you know, if Johnny was on the lower chords, Dee Dee would be okay to be on the middle of the bass or even on the high sometimes, you know?
Right. The song you said was written very quickly, and I hear that a lot. It's always the most amazing songs. Yeah. Of course, this was picked as the first single. You guys did a video for this, but you wrote it. Do you remember presenting it to the band, and what did they think?
I think they liked it okay. I think it was, you know, I mean, it's one of those ones where I think by then we'd been doing it long enough that it's like, okay, here's the new song. Let's do what we can with it. You know, we'll do it. And by the end of the recording, we'll see which songs sound outstanding. I don't remember an immediate reaction out of anybody, really. I thought it was just one in our wad of songs.
In your mind, and I say this as an All fan first, I was an All fan before I discovered Descendants. I was backwards. And did you ever think during this time, maybe not, you probably didn't have time to think, you guys had toured so much and all, you're just writing songs, you're going to do a Descendants record now, but did you think as you're writing this, like, man, this song's awesome. If we put this out on an all record, it's going to get the reaction and the traction that it gets. But if this goes on a Descendants record, maybe some people are going to hear this thing.
You know, Descendants are always going to be a more popular phenomena, I think, for whatever it's worth. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, that the thought crosses your mind. But, you know, I try not to think about it in those terms. Well, at least particularly during the writing of songs, because you just want the songs to be natural, be what they are, to be their own thing. And then, you know, when the other guys get in on it, maybe it gets a little more life. By the end of it, you have a fully ambulatory Frankenstein monster of a song walking around.
Well, because I had mentioned to Stefan when he was on here, we talked about Everything Sucks, the lone track that he wrote from this record, which that whole story was crazy. He was like, yeah, I just wrote this kind of throwaway song and ended up being the guys are like, it's going to be the first song on the record. He's like, are you kidding me?
We've always been convincing Stefan that he's a better songwriter than he thinks he is. You know, that's sort of the thing. If because you're an All fan, I can bring it up. The song Strip Bar.
Okay. All 8 seconds of it.
What do you think?
I went to the strip bar, tried to grab her by the world, but a big guy beat me up and threw me out the back door of the strip bar.
That was him joking about, you know, well, what am I going to write in a song? And he just spieled that out and it was like, okay, well, we're going to put that on the record now.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Yeah, we'll show you.
You know, thanks for that.
Well, no, but I mean, like, you know, you go back to that time period and, you know, and I believe I mentioned this in his episode, there was no internet. You know, the best you could find out about a new record is you walked into a record store or you saw a flyer or someone told you to show, hey, there's a new Descendants record. But, you know, my listeners know they've heard the story, but I was out on the road. This kid put us up in New York at his apartment and he had an advanced copy of Everything Sucks. And he popped that thing in and it was just, I couldn't believe it, because by that point, I, of course, was familiar with Descendants, but the last Descendants recordings I heard were what you guys did in the 80s.
Yeah, yeah.
And I wasn't equating it, even though it was the same band. I didn't know you guys yet. I didn't know the inner workings. So to me, it was a completely separate band. I heard this recording. It was like, oh my gosh, the mix with Andy Wallace. I mean, do you still think of it today? It sounds ripping. It's almost 30 years old.
You know, I haven't listened to that one in a real long time. I got to tell you, you know, this is going to sound really lame, but once you're done doing the song, and you know this because of your stuff, it's really rare that you'll go, oh, you know what? I really want to listen to what I did there, you know?
Yeah.
But still occasionally, you know, the odd record I did or, you know, or misplayed on, I'll put it on and find out. But I haven't listened to that record. Maybe I owe it a re-listen. I probably should just to make sure I'm playing the parts right.
Yeah, yeah. Well, of course, going on the Caffeine Nation tour with you guys, I mean, you were really, to me, the first punk band. And prior to that, I probably just wasn't paying attention. I was young. I was in the pit diving off. I wasn't paying attention to the musicianship of 7 Seconds or the Doughboys when I was seeing them at Janice Landing in St. Pete. When, by the time I got on the road with you guys, I sat there every night. And I can't stress enough what you guys taught us, me as a musician, about the importance of your craft. You know, I don't know of any band that practiced harder than you. I know when you guys moved to, what was it, Brookfield or Missouri?
Brookfield, Missouri.
You guys lived in some house. And when you were off the road home for 2 weeks, 3 weeks at a time, all you did is rehearse all day long. And that work ethic has just, I'll never forget it. And it made me feel like, wow, you can be proficient and you can be good as a punk band. You don't have to suck.
Well, you know, we had the examples of the Minutemen and Black Flag and guys who clearly, whatever else you wanted to say about them, they weren't exactly slackers in the musician department. You know, they were very, very, very good. And I feel like I can extend it to any number of bands from that era. But I think part of the beauty of the punk rock thing was it wasn't the important thing or smug. It wasn't like, look at me, I'm a bitching guitar player. It was more like, no, we got this cool band. We're going to, you know, all hunker down and do it.
Right.
Also, the practice thing's funny to me because when you have your first band, you know, practice is the best thing that happens to you all day.
Yeah.
You know? And then somewhere in there, after bands put a record out and start doing touring, somehow practice, a lot of them, it becomes kind of a chore or something. And I try to hang on to that early stage vibe of like, oh, this is really cool. I get to go over, like, to this day, I go over to Bill's house, typically 10 in the morning, and we practice for an hour, 2 hours, and hang out and play records. And I get a lot of the same charge out of it I did when I was still, you know, 18, 19 years old, going to my first practices with the Massacre guys.
Man, that's so refreshing to hear, Carl. I suffer from that. And it's not that I don't like my guys in my band. I love them. I suffer from that instinct, that guttural that's all you thought about all day long. You got in the rehearsal. We'd be in there for 9-10 hours.
Yeah. Yeah. And the thing is to keep it fun. You know, you have to fuck up your own songs. You have to, you know, come up with, you know, ways to make it fun for yourself. And we do, you know.
Yeah.
Bill and I spend a lot of time these days going down YouTube rabbit holes of different music and different people and artists that we might have in common, or we don't even. And, you know, we'll spend an hour or two going through that and then go back to it.
You know, and I know from watching you guys, and I got one last question before we jump into the track. I have to ask, and I've never asked a band this. You guys are amazingly proficient. Stefan's probably my favorite punk rock, if not the best punk rock guitarist, in my opinion, hit for his style. Bill is just a monster. You're in your own league as a bass player. Ask anybody. Do you think that you'd be as good Carl Alvarez in 2023 if you weren't hanging around with Bill and Stefan all these years? Because I know you guys have elevated each other.
You know, I had about 2 years in there after Stefan had quit the Massacre guys and moved to Washington, D.C., before I joined up with Descendants. And I kept playing, but I think the learning curve was much steeper with Bill and with Stefan, both of them in the band. You mm-hmm. know, so I played with some very, very good players in Salt Lake City of all sorts of styles of music. But just that thing, Stefan just kept writing more and more difficult music.
Yeah.
You know, that was a habit he had, and it forced me to get on board. Okay, well, I got to learn how to make this thing work. And Bill, well, I mean, you know, it's one of those things, hanging on for dear life is not really, that's not too inaccurate of a way to put it. When I joined the band, it's like, God, I hope I can, simply this, I hope I can play fast enough
yeah.
to play with this guy.
Right. You know? Right. I mean, the first time I saw All play, it was the first time I saw the three of you together. I swore Stefan had like some weird arthritic condition. His fingers were spread apart. He was playing these chords. I'm like, those aren't real chords. I think he was making up half of them. I'm like, this guy is next level.
He's discovered his dirty secret. Actually, there's quite a bit of Stefan invents a chord going on in our background. But also, you know, before the punk rock world even existed, Stefan was already a very, very competent guitar player. He was when I met him at age 12, and he got respect from adults, which was weird. And he'd go out on the corner and he'd busk, he'd play Hotel California or whatever it was. And because at the time he was very, very small, people would just throw money at him. And I remember going out and watching him busk and thinking, there's something in this music thing. This guy's, you know, got enough money to go raid the candy store with, you know, it was kind of rad. So he always had that in him. But the music before punk rock was a thing, for him, there was a lot of Frank Zappa, a lot of jazz music that I was completely unfamiliar with.
Yeah.
You know, the rock and roll of the 70s that you would expect, you know, Boston, Ted Nugent, stuff of that ilk was in there. But, you know, he had a whole different angle on how to work chords in from a very, very early point, I think. He liked the sound of them, you know.
Yeah, how he's able to blend the dissonance with the the pop sensibility. It's the fine line that he walks is beautiful.
Well, when I started playing bass for real, when I joined his band, we would sit in the living room of our basement punk rock drag apartment, and we would try to deliberately find the most dissonant note combinations between the bass and the guitar. Our reasoning was, if we can find where all the sour notes are, then it's one short step to knowing where all the right notes are. So we were kind of backwards.
I was going
to
say, you guys were going in reverse.
But we liked all that dissonant stuff, you know, and I worked at a library for a long time, and I used to bring home records that were interesting. And there was a classical composer named Béla Bartók, and a lot of his stuff has that same dissonant kind of tonality to it. But being punk rockers, his records took too long, so we'd put them on 45.
Sped them up.
You know, so we can get him out of the way. So maybe, yeah, Béla Bartók on 45 is part of Stefan's thing. Maybe not.
I love it. Well, the song is 2 minutes and 15 seconds, which this seems like not like it's lengthy and it feels like it's too long, but it feels more like a 3 or 4 minute song. It feels like a really complete tune. 2 minutes and 15 seconds. We got an 8-bar intro. There's a steady kick drum going right off the top. Stereo guitars are ringing out these big chords. Along with that kick drum, there's a steady hi-hat, a killer Bill Stevenson tom fill happening, and an amazing melodic bass part with these harmonics that you're doing there at the top. Really cool. Do you recall when you went to record this, was the harmonic part already there? I can't remember if it was on the demo or not.
I think it kind of came in later. I think that little high bit came in as we kept working on the song. And, you know, Bill is always very encouraging in terms of like, okay, we need something here. Put something here. We need the bass to do something here. And, you know, we'll sit around and mess around and invent a thing to fill the space, you know, or whatever it is that sounds cool to us, and move on. You know, on the Hypercaphium record, Bill and me did all the bass parts in his back bedroom at his house. And, you know, it was just kind of us hanging out, coming up with cool bass parts for 2 weeks. Because I really didn't have anything going into that. I had songs, but no real bass parts.
Have you ever been in rehearsal? I've done this. And you're playing this cool harmonic part. And you love it. No one really says anything about it. And you go to record it. And you do it. And they're like, dude, what is that? Or, I don't like that. And you're like, you're crushed. You're like, that's my part.
Yeah. I've been doing it the whole time, man. Yeah. What up?
Yeah. Like you could have said something 3 weeks ago and told me it sucked then. And now like, I love it. That's a hard one to swallow. I've had that happen.
Well, we kind of had a rule at a certain point where you're not allowed to tell a fellow band member that their part sucks unless you have a better idea.
I like that.
Cause it's at that level, it's just counterproductive, right?
Right.
Well, okay. I know what you don't want to hear. What do you want to hear there?
But what if you don't know what you want to hear? You just know what you hear sucks.
Then let us dialogue and come up with something that the both of us can live with.
Yeah, for sure.
Or sometimes a random person might have a better idea too, you know, because that's part of what we liked about having our roadie Daniel around for a lot of years was he was a really good, you know, he could bring things down to base level pretty quick, you know.
Yeah.
Being as his whole template of music was the Ramones, AC/DC, and Black Sabbath, and everything else is just pretend stuff.
Right, and sometimes that's all it takes. You'll have a second engineer in a studio, and he's going to get a sandwich, and as he's walking out, he's singing the song, but he sings a wrong lyric. You're like, whoa, what was that? Well, that's actually kind of cool.
Yeah, that's actually better. Let's go with that.
Yeah.
Yeah, we had when we did the Descendants All record and some of the All records, there was a guy named Richard Andrews who was in the production of it, and he was a much better bass player than I am. And there's stuff on those recordings where he was literally, you know, giving me ideas, telling me what he thinks should go there, knowing that I was very uneducated and very green. But he was, you know, he was a guy who, this music was not his music. He was a contemporary R&B guy. That's what he liked. But he gave me, you know, he'd give me ideas and point out little places I could put things in. He was a very talented guy.
Sounds like you were receptive to it, though. You were open to it.
Well, yeah, because I'd only been playing bass for like 4 or 5 years at that point. So I needed help.
Yeah, but you were young and a lot of kids know everything and they don't want to hear it. I've seen that so many times in studios, you know?
Yeah, well, I mean, that's a real thing because you do. It's hard work to learn how to even make the things make anything other than noise. You know, it's hard. And so when you get in the studio, also, I feel like in studio, it's a very vulnerable place for a lot of musicians to be.
Oh, yeah.
Because everything's really naked in there, you know?
Mm-hmm. And now you're under a microscope and it's only you in the vocal booth.
Yeah. And so the defensiveness, I understand where one would get defensive. And I've had to be defensive about certain stuff here and there. Sometimes to my detriment, you know, it's like, no, we need to keep that third or the fourth verse in or whatever. So I can listen to it again a couple of years later. And you're like, no, yeah, I could have lived without that fourth verse. Oh, well. Yeah, I should have listened to someone.
And that's hard to do because, you know, when you're in the moment, that's a snapshot of where you were right then. I try to remember that too, you know?
Oh, yeah.
Right out of the intro, 8-bar intro, we get chorus one. I'm the one. I've been here for you all along. I'm the one whose shoulder you've been crying on. We get harmonies on both I'm the ones there. And I gotta ask, later in the song, I swear it's Chad, and I know Chad Price has been credited with backing vocals on Everything Sucks, but is that you doing the harmonies on I'm the One?
You know, I couldn't even tell you nowadays. I can't even remember who ended up doing that. That was, you know, it's a long time ago. And also, you know, like you said, Chad, honestly, he's a much, much better singer than I am. So if we want to get stuff done quickly in studio, you call Chad. It'll be done very quickly.
Well, and I wanted to ask, you know, obviously Chad can sing. He's absolutely amazing. One of my favorite singers. Yeah. But does his voice, it's kind of in the same timbre as Milo's, kind of gruff. Does it mix a little bit better than yours? And maybe that's why he was doing some backing vocals, or was it just because he gets in there and kills it?
You know, I think maybe, but the weird thing about Chad and me is our voices at one point with the All stuff would do a weird thing in studio where their interaction, something between the gruff I had and the gruff he had, would create a third harmonic part.
Yeah.
That would drive the, you know, Bill and Hampton crazy trying to hunt down where that strange note is coming from.
Right.
It was just between our voices. So I don't know. Bill has a big part in the harmonies when we do this stuff because he's got a real gift, I feel like, for it.
Yes.
And so, you know, yeah, I think it ultimately would have come down to his call.
And I have a hard time telling it. Were these vocals double track the lead vocal? If they were, I can't tell.
I think most of the lead vocal tends to be double tracked with us, but a lot of attention is paid to making it perfectly in line, to sing it perfectly in line and not staggered. So there's no, it doesn't read that way. It just sounds like a real loud bitchin' vocal.
Yeah. Well, it's like that scene in Filmage when Scott, the second all singer, basically gets up there and says, yeah, I did. I sang She's My Ex perfectly. And I get done with it. And Bill's like, hey, go back in there and sing it again. He's like, what do you mean?
Now we
need
double.
Yeah.
Need to double it.
And maybe that's the case here. If it is, it's a tight double. Right out of the chorus, we go straight into verse one. Nice guys finish last. No one knows as good as me. We're just good friends. And you come to me for sympathy. And is this basically what you were sharing earlier about, you know, your friends coming to you?
I was sharing earlier about a lot of the guys I knew had this thing where the girl in question that they're interested in is clearly not interested in them and is dating other guys who are maybe not the best of people for them to be dating. You know, it's all part of, I guess this is all standard girl versus boy stuff. I think, you know, this is ancient. When you're talking about this stuff, the unrequited love factor, Cyrano, you know?
Yeah.
It's all in there.
Well, the first two lines, Bill goes to a Tom Shuffle beat while the vocals are happening. Then the band plays straight in between. And then we're going to get into what I'm calling the pre-chorus. The chord progression changes here. You tell me that I'm not so tired, but still you call me late at night. Every time it breaks the fight, after all is said and all is done. You tell me that I'm not your type, but still you call me late at night. Every time he picks a fight, after all he's said and all he's done. I mean, who can't relate to those lyrics, though? And I've had that happen. I had plenty of female friends, some of whom, you know, I kind of had a liking to. I was like, why are you hanging out with this guy? He's terrible.
Yeah. Well, I think a lot of the time, the idea of being a friend to a woman is confusing for both people involved. I think a lot of the time in that sort of scenario, the woman doesn't necessarily know there is romantic interest, or the guy doesn't know how to express that there is romantic interest, and it can be very confusing. Or maybe there's nothing there, you know. In this case of this song, clearly this guy believes that our narrator Milo believes that, like, you know, I'm the guy that ultimately, when you're done messing around, you're gonna find me, because I've been here the whole time. I gave her everything
don't care. Hey everyone, don't go anywhere. We got lots more coming up with Carl Alvarez after a few words from our sponsors.
Hey, this is Aaron from No Simple Road. I'm inviting you to come hang out with Apple, Mel, and I as we talk with the musicians, artists, chefs, authors, and beyond from the world that turns us on. We're reaching into the improvisational music scene, the psychedelic culture, the festival world, and getting to know what makes the people tick that create those scenes. Come join us on the long, strange trip over at No Simple Road.
Hey, it's Chris DeMakes, a podcast producer, Chris Fafalius. Will you do me a favor real quick? Go to Apple Podcasts or Spotify or wherever you listen to podcasts and subscribe to One Hit Thunder. It's the show that I host with my good buddy Matt Kelly, where we have guests from the world of music and comedy and art, and together we dive deep into a band or artist that people consider a one-hit wonder and decide if they brought the thunder or were just a blunder. You'll laugh, you'll learn, maybe you'll get mad at us, who knows? We have an enormous back catalog that includes episodes about Eagle Eye Cherry, Stacey Q, Looking Glass, The Weather Girls, Tag Team, Four Non-Blondes, Martika, Krayshawn, Sixpence None the Richer. I could go on and on, but how about you just subscribe to One Hit Thunder wherever you get your pods and experience the fun for yourself. No, she don't. 10 years before. And now, back to the show.
Something about this track, I can't see this on any other Descendants record prior to Everything Sucks. The musicianship, everything about you, you guys had, to me, just, it's a different animal at this point. However, this lyric could sit in on a number of those records, I feel.
Yeah, probably. It could sit in on the on all of the Descendants stuff. I mean, that, like I said, the unrequited love song thing, I mean, that's the song Hope is very much that.
Yeah.
You know, there's quite a bit of that in the early catalog, but, you know, romance is romance, you know. In the current era, it's kind of, you know, I've had people express the opinion that both those songs are a bit stalkery or weird. And I'm kind of like, well, okay, well, we have a song called Stalker if you want the song about being a stalker. These aren't that.
Yeah.
You actually have the song about that.
Yeah, we wrote that already.
So if you want to complain about that, you can complain about that.
Right, right.
These ones are, you know, romantic obsession songs.
Well, in pre-chorus one, Bill goes to the ride here, along with that classic surf rock Motown double snare thing that he does. And again, I'm calling this pre-chorus one because the chord progression does change here at the very last line, after all he's said and all he's done, which we hear that line a number of times in this song. That line, to me, is a hook that has to be here, especially later in the song when it just perfectly bridges the gap between the bridge and chorus four later on. But I love, this is such a Descendants all-ism here at the very end, where the bass hits with the guitars and the drums, the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, do you know, when you're going up to
the high.
It's just so good. It's on the demo, that part. Was that something that you remember working out in the studio, or that's, you just did it?
I don't know about that. I mean, for me, the roots of the song are kind of in the way the changes work. And there's a lot of weird half step changes through the whole song.
Yeah.
That are a little untypical for this genre or for any of them. But that, I think kind of how that bit leading up to the chorus, I honestly feel like that's kind of Roy Orbison or something. It's just this, if you put it in your head, you can hear Roy Orbison singing that melody as it, you know, as the bit ascends, you know?
Wow. That's a crazy example. I never thought in a million years I would hear that or reference that, to think about that in context of this song. But yeah, I could hear him singing that, how you go up there, those steps.
Well, there's a lot of oldies bullshit in what I do. I can't speak for the other guys. I know with Bill, the Beach Boys have always been a big part of his world.
Oh, yeah. So,
and with Stefan, big Beatles fan. And we all were raised with that radio when we were young and all that. Like, what was the first song you remember, you really remember as a kid, that affected you?
Free Ride by Edgar Winter Group.
That's a good one. That's a really good one. Yeah, I mean, I was younger, but I remember distinctly sitting at my grandma's breakfast table and, you know, listening to the radio. And I remember the song, the Motown song, The Temps, I Can't Help Myself.
Oh, yeah.
And there was something about that song I really liked. And then it was followed up by Help Me Rhonda by the Beach Boys. And something about those two things just kind of, I think everything comes from that moment of like liking the way that felt to hear that stuff.
I can relate to that because I'm a sucker to this day for the dual harmony guitar that Boston and Iron Maiden and all these guys.
Oh, yeah.
And that stems straight from Edgar Winter Group. They were doing that.
See, that's the only reason you guys should ever have a second guitar.
Exactly. I know.
You can do the tandem guitar parts.
Well, we got a frustrated guitarist. He plays bass, Roger. But
yeah, I know that. I know that story. Well, you play bass sometimes nowadays, right?
Yeah, I got one sitting right here, but I'm not that good. But coming out of pre-chorus one, Carl, we get another chorus. We got the same lyric, but I did notice, and I've never noticed this, the last line at the very top of the song, it says, whose shoulder you've been crying on? But here it says, the shoulder you've been crying on. Do you recall that happening? Or was...
I probably had a specific reason to do that, but I'll be fucked if I can tell you what it is. You know,
yeah.
I mean, yeah. You know, I'm sure there was some small argument in the studio over which word was going there or whatever.
Do you know, a lot of time we as singers, we just screw up and we say the instead of whose shoulder, we just said the. It ended up being a take. A lot of times I've found out, and I didn't know this, especially when we were going analog back in the day, mixers sometimes had the liberty to pull up another piece of tape or pull up something like, wait, what is this? And like, they would put that in there and be like, that's the take. And you'd hear it and be like, wait a second, the lyric is whose? It's not,
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But, you know.
Because they're not necessarily paying attention to the lyric when they're doing a tape edit.
They're
just like.
Yeah, that's not.
They're just trying to make sure that we actually can get it to line up properly so it isn't a dog's dinner, you know?
Well, who knows there? Again, we get harmonies on I'm the One both times. We're right into verse 2. He's a total dick. That's the truth and you know I'm right. Of everything you say, it isn't will ever do you right. He's a total dick. That's the truth and you know I'm right. From everything you say, there's no way he'll ever do you right.
Someone in there was trying to like get a rise out of me. Like, are you really going to use he's a total dick as the lead in line?
Yeah, absolutely.
Like, oh, yeah, hell yeah. Well, a lot of it, this is how people speak. It's not like I'm coming up with something. I'm being staggeringly creative here. All I'm doing is this is how people talk.
I can't tell you how many times I feel like I'm talking to Skiba. Another one is Brennan from Lawrence Arms. Some of their lyrics, that's exactly how they talk. That Midwestern, you know, kind of cockiness.
Yeah.
And yeah. So
you know, I mean, that's the beauty of it, right?
Yeah, I get it from that aspect. Verse two here, same general instrumentation as verse one, but man, your bass playing gets really playful on the back half here. And I got to ask you, and it's awesome. Do you have a lot of liberty with yourself to play around, or do you usually get it in the first take or two?
I usually have a rough idea what I'm doing, but it'll take me a while to get it perfected.
Yeah.
Usually.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I mean, the main rule, of course, is just stay out of the way of everyone else. if you're going to be pulling off all these bass things, you know, you don't want to step on anyone's dick, particularly the vocal melody. You don't want to distract from that.
Sure.
So, you know, it's stuff to keep in mind when you're getting inventive or uppity on bass, you know.
It's really difficult to do when you're in a punk rock band and your tempos are what they are most of the time. There's a lot going on. There's a lot of stuff on top of each other.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, sometimes it gets down to appropriate stuff because when I was with the Real McKenzies, Little Joe Raposo had been their bass player before me.
Oh, wow.
And we all know what Little Joe does. And, you know, he's a bruiser. But I got in there and I sized it up. It's like, we have three guitar players and two bagpipe players. Someone's got to take the low road on this stuff. So I simplified a bunch of Joe's parts for the sake of this, of being out of the way of the pipers and the guitar players.
And man, that is so cool though, Carl, because, you know, again, maybe you could have. You seem like you've kind of been a little more mature in your years, even as a younger musician. But a lot of younger guys can't see the forest through the trees, so to speak. And like, hey, I know my place here. I got to stay back. You've seen those show-off drummers that just can't help themselves.
Yeah. You see it in like virtually all instruments. You'll see that element in it. But I think that's the mark. I mean, a lot of music is very cooperative. You know, you have to listen to the people, like I said before, you listen to the people around you and you don't want to step on anyone's toes particularly. You know, make something stronger. The gestalt has to add up or whatever. And yeah, no, it's, but you know, like you said, it's maybe it is a mature thing or maybe it's a lot of team sports as a kid or something. I just always had that instinct.
I've said that before. I don't know how many times on this show. I feel like some of the musicians, myself included, that have been coached in sports, it's helped me accept the producer's role, accept the, you know, somebody kind of being a coach, the fifth member of the band. And it's helped me to look at it that way, because there's some guys that didn't play sports or just they froze when they got in that situation. It's like, wait, someone's telling me what to do? Wait, this is new.
Yeah, no one's ever done that before.
Right? Yeah.
Also, I did theater productions in high school like everyone else. You know, having a director was not alien, you know.
That's really insightful. Well, pre-chorus too. You love a man who takes you long. You think you'll change him, but you're wrong. He'll use you then, he'll stay so long. After all he's said and all he's done. You love a man who treats you wrong. You think you'll change him, but you're wrong. He'll use you, then he'll say so long. After all he's said and all he's done. So the last line here is the tie-up. We get that again. How important was that to get that line in there? Was there ever a different line, or was that what it had to be?
No, that was it. That was the callback to make it all kind of be symmetrical and line up and make progressive sense.
Yeah. You know? I never realized how important that line was to this song. And I've heard this song, I'm not even going to say hundreds of times. I've heard this song probably thousands of times. How important and relevant that line is to this song. That really ties it up right there. I if you would have asked me 2 days ago, I'd just say, no, it's I'm the one. I've been here, you know, that's the lyric. Yeah. No, this is really it to me. After all he's said and all he's done, you know, you're not going to see, I'm standing here.
And that's where you get your knight in shining armor moment or whatever out of it, I guess. I don't know.
Well, chorus three, and listen, I haven't mentioned this. There's no fat on this at all. There's no fat on this bone. I mean, this is just 2 minutes and 15 seconds. We're into chorus three. We get the harmonies on I'm the One on the first and third line. And it says the shoulder you've been crying on before we hit the bridge here. I'm the one. I love this bridge. It's perfect. Not only does it get tied together here at the end with that lyric that we've been talking about, after all I've said and all I've done, but at the top of the bridge, you get the lyric, I'm the one that starts it off. I'm the one who wants you more than anything. You don't feel the same way. You made it clear to me, but I'll stand my ground and maybe you'll hear what I've been saying. After all I've said and all I've done. So the lyric does change there to first person, after all I've said and all I've done versus all he said and all he's done.
Yeah, Yeah, it's that's deliberate. It's, you know, yeah. You got to make it make sense on some level and give it a narrative sensibility. It's the, or just the juxtaposition. What's he saying and he him doing? What am I saying? What am I doing?
Was that lyric always the same? And again, I can't recall from the demo. I just listened to the demo this morning.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that one was.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure that one was always there.
I think for context, it has to be. On the second line, Carl, I'm the one who wants you more than anything. On than anything, there's a harmony. And on the fourth line, clear to me, there's a harmony. And I swear that's Chad there for sure.
I'd have to listen and find out. I don't think so, though. I think those are me.
Those are
if
you.
If I remember.
Maybe I have it backwards then.
I'm not sure.
Okay.
I'm not sure, though.
I mean, yeah.
Once again, once it's in the can, so to speak, you tend to, it's like COVID, you know, it goes down the memory hole. You forget about what had happened.
There you go. Well, the last line here, that lyric, it's such a hook. It perfectly ties this bridge together to launch chorus 4. I'm the one. Chorus 4 is the first and only double chorus of the song. I'm the Ones are all harmonized, and we end on I'm the One at the very end where the band ends abruptly. And the two lines here, the shoulder you've been crying on, it's not whose shoulder like the very first chorus. So all the rest of them were the, and I know this record was not done to Pro Tools, so nothing was flown around here. So that was definitely deliberate. Yeah.
Unless it was a tape edit, and I'm not aware of it.
Okay.
You know, that's, like you said, that was your only option back then, and sometimes it led to funny results.
Sure.
You know?
Now, when you did the Pummel record, and I'm trying to, did you guys mix that yourself, or who mixed the Pummel album?
When we did that, we had, trying to remember the fella's name, one of the guys who'd done Appetite for Destruction, believe it or not.
Okay, was it Mike Klink?
No, I'm trying to remember the guy's name. It's not coming to me right now, but he came in, we had to fire him once or twice on the way to finishing the record. This was, you know, a major label record and they wanted to have their guy in there. But I think Bill managed to browbeat and get most of what we wanted out of the record, out of this guy. I'm not sure. I mean, it's always weird. That was the first time we had really worked with someone in that capacity. You know, we had never done that.
The reason I ask, I mean, Pummel to me, when that came out, that was the best sounding record that you guys had done up to that point, Descendants and all. In fact, probably one of my favorite guitar tones on any record Stefan's ever done. Something really special on that record to me.
Yeah, and we had the budget for it too. You know, that was a lot of it.
Right.
You know, that was the budget to make a good record.
But when I heard Everything Sucks, there was an energy here and an urgency that just, I mean, it comes screaming out of the speakers. And I was driving last night, and I'll always do this before I do an episode. I'll get in my car where I know how my music sounds, as we all do. And I crank this song up last night. I'm going to the grocery store and every hair in my neck stand up. Next thing I know, I'm doing 65 and a 45. I got to calm down. It sounds like a truck coming at you. Do you remember getting the mix back? What'd you think?
I was very, very, very enthusiastic about it. I remember that. But, you know, back to what you were saying before, it's not, I think a lot of people do this. We go for the car listen. Like when you get a mix, in the old days, it would be on a cassette.
Yeah.
You take it out to the car, preferably one with a pretty shitty stereo, you know, because you can't guarantee everyone's going to be listening to this on state-of-the-art stuff.
No.
And if you can get through the shitty stereo, then you've probably done a pretty good job. But the car listen was a big part of it.
Yeah.
You know, the process of it.
Because I'm telling you, this by all accounts was a major label record. I mean, you had Andy Wallace mix it. And by this point, Bill and Stefan knew how to engineer as good as any of these guys out there.
They had learned a lot.
They had. I mean, go back a short 6-7 years, listen to the, you know, Home Again by the Doughboys. Just doesn't sound, I mean, you know, a lot of that has to do with the band too, but I mean, where these guys came in.
No. It's like with the production with Bill and Stefan, they'll be the first to admit they learned as they went.
Yeah. Yeah.
They, you know what I mean? And they learned from the people they worked around. And with Bill, that starts with Black Flag it starts with Spot, actually, who passed on last year. And then when they were working Black Flag, he was trying to learn during that period. And then so on and so forth. Stefan got in the picture and he has his own production ideas and ethoses, and they started producing other people's records in LA, and it was all towards the good in terms of learning. Though I do think the Chemical People Soundtracks record is probably my favorite of that era.
Yeah, let's give a shout out to Chemical People. Love that band. So underrated. Such a great band. A lot of those bands you guys ran with back then, Big Drill Car, Doughboys, absolutely loved it.
Oh, every time I hear Drill Car, it's just a great feeling, because I remember just how good they were. They were such a great band live, and the recordings just, it's like a cool breeze, you know.
It's wonderful stuff. Yeah, I know. Let's go back now. You did the first Caffeine Nation tour. That would have been the fall of 96, early 97. I know Suicide Machines were out with you guys on that. I think Shades Apart. Do you remember, it's going back a few years here, but do you remember playing I'm the One? And you remember the crowd reaction? And the reason I ask, you know, when we put out new records now, Carl, any band, I don't care if it's the Rolling Stones, Metallica, you know, people have those memories attached to those old songs. It's hard to get into the new stuff. I swear to you, when Everything Sucks came out, it was like a greatest hits Descendants record. I remember the fans just taking to it right away. Was that your perception of it?
Yeah, I thought it was pretty unusual, you know, because Descendants, even as Descendants, have faced that, because the Descendants All album was quite a departure from what the Enjoy album was all about. And the Enjoy album certainly is a departure from what Grow Up is about.
Yeah.
You know, so we had already met backlash to the point of when I remember notably playing on the Descendants All album on tour, someone literally yelling up, "Your new songs suck," while we were playing them.
Jeez.
So, you know, it takes a while. So I was surprised that the Everything Sucks album was, you know, so uniformly embraced as, you know, the thing.
Well, you didn't put out a crappy record, I'll tell you that, and that had a lot to do with it.
And we got Frank to put a song on it, and we got Tony. Mm-hmm. So, it is very important to me that the guys who contributed get their due. Because I'm like the fourth bass player in this band, dude.
I know.
You know?
I know.
There's a lot of heritage there.
No, and I've always loved that you've respected the lineage of the band. All of you guys have, you know, like the Ninth and Walnut project. I mean, you were able to step back and for the betterment of the team. That's such a, man, there's not a lot of bands that can then separate the egos and all that.
Tony, you know, I was like every other kid in 1983 when Milo Goes to College came out. I put that record on and I don't think it left the turntable for like 3 months.
So
we were obsessed with that thing.
Yeah.
You know? Because, well, it was so out of the blue because we had heard the Fat EP. We had heard that. And Milo Goes to College was another, you know, light years ahead in terms of the evolution. So it kind of caught us napping. Like, what is the hell? What the hell is this thing?
Right.
Oh my God. This is the best record. It used to annoy quite a few of our friends because we were into that record.
I bet.
As much as we were.
Well, listen, Carl, I could talk to you about what we're talking about right now for like 3 hours. But hey, I want to thank you for taking the time. I know you've been busy. And before we break here, what do you got for everyone listening? What's coming up with Descendants? You got any solo stuff? Any All records coming out? I didn't even ask you guys this last time. I ask you every time.
Oh, God. With the All records, I don't even know. We've been promising one for years, and I'm certainly into it. But no formal plans have been made. The new Descendants record, Stefan and Milo have recorded their songs. Their songs are in the can. Bill and I are being the stick in the muds.
Oh, my gosh.
So maybe while I'm home for the next 3 or 4 months, I'll actually be able to demo my new bunch of songs and try to see what I can get out of that. And Bill can demo his. We just haven't done it. We've been very lazy about it.
Right on, man. Well, again, thank you so much for taking the time. I appreciate it. And this was as much fun for me as everybody listening, I'm sure. While you are away, I'm waiting. I'm out of my mind, you're out of town.
We did it. We had all the Descendants on Krista Makes a Podcast now. If you haven't heard the past episodes, we have 2 episodes with Bill, an episode with Stefan, an episode with Milo. We got an episode with Chad Price. Just take a look back through our back catalog if you haven't heard those episodes yet. But don't do that yet. There's still more Krista Makes a Podcast to come right after a few words from our sponsors.
Hi, I'm Daniela Clark.
I'm Barbara Ann Wild.
And we are The Honest AF Show.
Our podcast is real, honest conversation with our celebrity friends and pros.
Covering our anything but average rock and roll lifestyles.
All while tackling the hell that is aging and the battle of beauty.
Oh yeah, nothing is off the table.
The Honest AF Show is available wherever you get your podcasts.
As we near the end of the show, here's a band you might not know.
Welcome to this week's Band You Might Not Know. If you'd like your band to be considered for Krista Makes a Podcast, email your best song via MP3 only and a short bio to bandyoumightnotknow@gmail.com. This week's featured artist is Headways, a pop punk band from Pennsylvania, featuring Cameron on lead vocals, Dan on guitar, Dylan on the drums, and Sean on the bass. You can find them on Instagram at Headways Music. Here's a snippet of their song, Ghost.
The Wrap with Chris and Chris.
Chris, we did it. We got all the Descendants.
All four. And man, we had to chase Carl down for a little bit. Thankfully, his wife intervened. Thanks, Jen.
Well worth the wait, because I don't know from your perspective if you think this, Chris, but I know from my world, I'm the One is probably the signature Descendant song in my world. If you would ask anyone that I roll with what the most popular Descendant song is, they'd probably say I'm the One. Do you agree with that?
I do. And I had a really funny conversation with Bill 2 weeks ago when we played Fest about that, because they repeated a couple songs, but they had did a Fest warm-up show on the Thursday before Fest. And I was in town early and me and the guys went down to see him play. And it was just hit after hit after hit. And I had jokingly said to him the next day, I said, well, what are you going to play tonight? He's like, what do you mean? I'm like, well, last night was hit after hit. He goes, you think last night was hits? I'm like, yeah. You played Hope. You played I'm the One. He goes, I'm the One's a hit? He goes, well, I guess to you, because you weren't really into us back in the 80s. You were too young. So I'm the One's like a new song to you. I'm like, I wouldn't say it's new, Bill. It's almost 30 years old. But yeah, yeah. I knew what he meant by it. It made me chuckle. But as I said to Carl, Chris, top 10 Descendants song that never goes out of the top 10. My top 10 does rotate with Descendants, but I'm the One's always there. It's a staple.
Yeah, it's amazing. And I thought it was really cool that Carl was talking about how he's still able to maintain the excitement and fun of band practice and have it not be a chore. Because I'll tell you what, man, I try to be that way. I'll tell you this. Once I'm there and I'm playing, I'm having fun. But kind of sometimes you're like, oh, I got to drive to band practice. I got to lug in my equipment. I got to do this stuff. And yeah, it can turn into a chore. And that was inspiring to me when he said that. I thought to myself, I have to make sure band practice is always fun. I never want to think of it that way.
Yeah. And I definitely took a page out of that too. I was like, man, I gotta come up with some excitement. And I think a lot of it, Chris, is band practice was such a new thing then. It was either band practice or your crappy job that you had, or for me, it was the college classes that I didn't want to go to. So practice was just like this mecca, like let's get to practice. Whereas nowadays, you know, we've gotten older. We have families and all this other stuff that detracts you away from that. But I'm going to try to remember that next time I walk into rehearsal.
I do remember the days after school or whatever, and I knew I had band practice that night, and being like, oh, hell yeah, we got band practice tonight. I want to try to get more in that mindset nowadays. I think that would be cool.
Yep.
I thought it was a good point you brought up about saying that the people you play with elevate you. Mm-hmm. You know, for Carl I'm sure he elevates them too. They're all, as you would say, they're all rippers.
Yeah.
So I'm sure they all elevate each other, but who you play with can make you such a better musician.
Yeah. You know, the old adage, it's so true. The company you keep, you know, if you want to be a hairstylist and you're hanging around the disco every night, you're probably not going to be that good. But if you're at the salon every day, and it's the same thing here, if you're hanging around people of your caliber or better, you're going to improve if you stick around long enough. And those guys, they just keep getting better. Bill's doing a thing now, Chris, because he's gone to in-ears. And so he'll wear in-ear monitors, but he'll also wear noise-canceling headphones on the outside of it. So he's almost completely isolated back there. And he's hitting... Actually, he's not hitting. He's missing like hi-hat parts and cymbal parts. When I say he's missing them, he's deliberately leaving them out as to not crowd a part. I can't even explain it, but I talked to him about this, and it's almost like he's playing lighter and he's playing more like a jazz drummer, and he agreed with me on all fronts. And he said, yeah, it's these in-ears. He goes, I'm hearing things. He's like, why do I have to hit the cymbal there coming back into it when it doesn't need to be? Let the guitars and the bass do that. And I'm sitting there going, my God, gosh, this guy's still learning after 40 years of doing this. How inspirational.
Yes, that definitely is. And that relates right to what you were talking to Carl about when you were saying, well, he was saying anyway, that as a bassist, it's important not to step on everything else in the mix, not to overplay. You don't want to be playing some crazy bass line and overpowering the vocal or the guitar or something. You have to be tasteful about what you play. And I think that's, we've talked about that before in the rap and on the after party and stuff, that you see, especially sometimes in young bands, usually with inexperience, you see people overplaying.
Oh gosh.
And it just, yeah, it sounds bad. Even if what you're playing is technically difficult and technically musically proficient or whatever, it can sound terrible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've seen bands where the kid, like, you know, you can tell Travis Barker's his favorite drummer. He's just doing a fill every couple bars, and it's just like, yeah, you gotta give the other people in your room or band some room here, kid. It's not working.
Travis Barker is obviously an amazing drummer, but he is responsible for thousands of drummers that dress like him and try to unsuccessfully play like him in local bands for decades after.
Yes.
Thanks a lot, Travis. Also, I wanted to bring up from this episode, Chris, I love the he's a total dick line.
Yeah.
If it was he's a total jerk or he's a total dweeb, whatever, it wouldn't have the same effect. That is a perfect line, and I don't feel like the song would be the same song without it.
It wouldn't. Carl said it perfectly. It's just like we'd sit around talking. You're hanging out with your buddies, like, you know, or somebody. He's a total dick. That's how you'd talk. And
right.
And I like that. And I like when that comes across in song. I never really thought about that lyric. I never knew he got any grief for it being corny or whatever. I think it's awesome.
Yeah. And I love the rule that they have about you can't say something sucks unless you have a better idea than that. I love that rule because, I mean, this would be an example, right? Oh, you don't like the he's a total dick line? Well, what's better than that?
Yeah.
What's going to make more of an impression than that?
Yeah, if you can best that line, then let's hear it. I do like that rule as well.
And one more thing I want to touch on, Chris, is the car test. I'm sure we've talked about the car test before. The ultimate test when you get your mix back. This is how people, I mean, at least probably half the time, maybe more than that, are going to be hearing your song, just like probably a lot of people are hearing our podcast in the car.
Yep.
So you want to experience it, not through these $20,000 amazing studio monitors where probably everything's going to sound great. You want to hear it where the average Joe's going to be hearing it to see how they experience it. And if it sounds good through some crappy car stereo speakers, you know that it's a good mix.
That's right. And I'll tell you, I'd love for our supporting cast, our after party, to be coming through your crappy car speakers. So for only $5 a month, you can go to chrisdemakes.com and join our supporting cast. It's like a Patreon where you'll get bonus episodes each week of the after party. That's right. Chris and I each week will fill your heads with laughter and facts and history and all kinds of great things. The after party at chrisdemakes.com. Help us out. We appreciate it. We love doing this podcast, and we know a lot of you love it as well. And if you haven't already, please give our Chris DeMakes a Podcast Facebook group a join. We'd love to have you in there. Over 5,000 active members. And Chris, you're still on Instagram, buddy, at Chris Fafalia, so make sure to give Chris a follow over there. I don't forget about you, Chris.
I'm there. And Chris, don't forget, I know we're hitting people with a lot of stuff at the end of these episodes, but don't forget to go subscribe to the Chris DeMakes a Podcast YouTube channel, where I've been putting a lot of clips from the episodes. People want some video clips, and I like to give the people what they want. So the Chris DeMakes a Podcast YouTube channel. You should go check it out. maybe give it a little subscription.
Absolutely. And give me a follow on Instagram, too, at @LessThanChrisD. And want to thank my old friend Carl Alvarez for sitting in the hot seat with us today. We'll catch you next week.
Hey, everybody. Satan here. I know what you're thinking. Jesus Christ, Satan has a podcast now, too? No, that's not it. But I am here to tell you about a podcast, and it's one that's all about my favorite band, Punchline. Not the band you expected me to say, right? You probably figured I'd like Slayer, or maybe some backwards Beatles records or something. Those are okay, but you usually find me rocking out to fan favorite Punchline albums like Action or Lion while I'm torturing dead people for all of eternity. Punchline's podcast is called A Band Called Punchline, and it's super entertaining to listen to this documentary-style look back at the 25 years of my favorite band. Honestly, I'm really feeling like I'm getting to know these guys, and their story is amazing. I'm so ready for them to get down here. I have so many questions. I gotta give them credit for catching on to my whole 37 thing, too. There's a reason why they're my favorite band, and if you listen to their podcast, they might become yours, too. A Band Called Punchline is available wherever you listen to podcasts. Check it out, and I'll see you all in hell.
Hey you, do you have any plans this year? How's that going? Did you get 2020? Well, welcome to a brand new podcast called 2020, where myself, Benny Goodman, and my good friends Corey Pazin and Siobhan Cronin from the band Lost Symphony also got 2020.
And since the world ended this year, we decided why not just check in with some of our friends in the music industry and see how everyone's doing.
We're going to get a candid look at life on and off the stage, as well as the mindset of some of the most successful people in the entertainment industry.
New episodes drop every Sunday and Wednesday at 9 p.m. Eastern.
And you can listen at 2020-D.com, SoundTalentMedia.com, or on your favorite podcast app.
Hey, this is Chris Swinney, formerly of the Ataris and currently host of That One Time on Tour, part of the Sound Talent Media Podcast Network. Have you ever wondered what it's really like on the road? The highs can be euphoric, but the lows can be crushing. Join me every week as I chat with industry pros about what it's like living out their wildest dream and, in some cases, their worst nightmare. Past guests of the show include members of NoFX, Pennywise, Bad Religion, and more. Listen and subscribe at SoundTalentMedia.com.